Jim, I, you know, with the growth of government in our society and people demanding more government, I think it's a kind of interesting idea to think about what is the legitimate role of government in a free society. Have you ever given that any thought?
Oh, I've given that a lot of thought, and I agree fundamentally with you that we don't think nearly enough about it, especially the general public doesn't think enough about it. I'm not one of those, as you know, I'm not one of those anarcho-capitalists who sort of thinks that there's no role for government. In one sense, I'm a philosophical anarchist, but on the other hand, I think government's absolutely necessary, but it's necessary in a limited way. Mm-hmm. I go along very much, I think, with the sort of James Madison view that the role of government, and particularly the central government, is to sort of provide the parameters within which we play the economic political game. That is, that's the reason I, you know, of course, stress this emphasis on the constitutional rules. We need to have fairly fixed, stable structure of law and property and contract, and plus a few other governmental functions, but all those are kind of parametric functions within which we play. And the real problem of this century or and earlier has been the idea that somehow government can go beyond that and manipulate and control and manage not only the economy but all other aspects of our life.
Or whatever suits the will of a majority,
political
majority, which is really stands in the face of what the Founding Fathers thought when they said, well, we're going to limit the government to do certain things that's expressed in the Articles of the Constitution. And I'm at a loss to try to understand how did Congress escape these limitations that were originally imposed on them?
No, I think that's a fascinating question, and I don't know that we have any answers. It more or less, you know, as you know, people have tried to explain why this happened. There were some watershed, events. Of course, we fought a bloody civil war, and that removed the threat of secession. As long as states could threaten secession as a potential possibility, that automatically sort of put a check on the central government. Once that was gone, then the sort of general philosophy in the last part of the last century and the early years of this century was for limited government. You remember Grover Cleveland vetoed a bill to provide seed corn to the Midwest farmers because the federal government couldn't do that.
That's
that wasn't
right.
Constitutional. And
by the way, these questions never come up in Congress today. We're never asked the question, well, is this constitutional?
Right.
They just say, well, can we get a vote on
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
And we find, as you were suggesting, that the 10th Amendment is virtually meaningless nowadays. I try to think of one thing. I would imagine that a lawyer might be disbarred for bringing up the 9th or 10th Amendment.
Absolutely. And you don't find amongst the legal scholars anybody except Richard Epstein who even talks about those kind of problems anymore. But then we got this sort of progressive movement around the turn of the century, and then that was finally put in play in the debacle that we went through in the New Deal, where they were just searching around for everything. And as Jonathan Hughes, an economic historian, once said, the main thing the New Deal did was invent new ways to spend money.
That's right.
You got this whole threshold leap. And we've been living with that ever since.
And then, you know, Robert Higgs, he points out that one of the problems is that wars increase the role of government, and maybe rightfully so in the context of war, but you never get back to where you were before.
Yeah, it's a ratchet effect, right?
Yes.
Exactly. And we've got away from kind of what I like to think of as a kind of a constitutional attitude. That is, the public doesn't understand government in its limited role, and certainly the politicians themselves don't understand it. And somehow or another, we've slipped into this fallacy of thinking that democracy properly means majority rule. But if you take that literally, majority rule means majority rule, which means the minority is going to get screwed.
Mm-hmm.
As they have throughout our history. But now it's becoming, as you said, it's becoming much more blatant.
And that's right. And I think that American people don't realize that there's nothing necessarily sacrosanct about majority rule. Indeed, it can be tyranny, as is pointed out in the Federalist Papers. And majority rule can simply boil down to meaning equality and servitude, as it's beginning
to
mean today.
Absolutely. I think we need to somehow get back to our, what you might call our constitutional understanding, our constitutional roots, but I don't see much movement in that direction. And what is strange, especially in the modern setting, is that the United States seems to be going the opposite direction from the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Our American domestic politics now seems to me to be informed by an attitude that reflects no influence whatsoever of the great revolutions that have happened in this decade.
That's right.
Absolutely no influence. So that's hard to understand. It's hard to understand.
Yes, as a matter of fact, when you hear during the last several elections, when you hear presidents talking about or people asking presidential candidates, what's your economic plan? I find that rather amazing because, you know, the bosses in Eastern Europe had economic plans. In the Soviet Union, they had economic plans in China and Cuba and North Korea. And if you ask what's the common characteristic of all these economic plans, they've been failures.
Yeah.
They've led to lower standards of living and lower human rights protections. And lo and behold, we have Americans asking for the same thing.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And I'm at somewhat of a loss just as to what is the solution. But some years ago, I'm sure you remember, we were on a committee, Lou Euler's National Tax Limitation Committee, and we were writing the constitutional amendment to limit spending. Now, of course, that didn't make it. Actually, it passed the Senate, but it did not make it through the House. It didn't come up for a vote. Do you continue to see some kind of limit on federal spending as a percentage of the GNP as one of the means to get us back to a more constitutional form of government?
I certainly think that's one possibility. Another one that's a little bit less sweeping than that is, of course, was involved in that same movement, is the movement to get a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. That has passed the Senate, has passed almost passed the House. It's still a movement. 32 states have put in resolutions, as you know. There's still a good deal of momentum of that, although it sort of went out in the middle of the 80s when the Graham-Rudman legislation went in, which sort of legislated that. And, of course, that was abandoned, as we could have predicted. There may be some resurgence of that movement. Especially as the deficit doesn't, as the deficit doesn't get resolved, but something like that needs to be done. Whether or not you're ever going to get it or not, it's another problem. Getting constitutional amendments put in is a very difficult thing to accomplish. I have been encouraged, and in one sense, I suspect both of us would agree that almost anything that seems to capture the public imagination, which would have the impact of limiting the dominance of the central government, would be desirable. And in one sense, we sort of have to jump on the bandwagon of anything that seems to capture the public imagination. And in that sense, the movement in the late 80s and 90s for a term limit seems to be that which is gathering a lot of focus, a lot of attention. So maybe that's going to take the play away from these specific spending limits or balanced budget requirement. It may well be that we're moving in the direction of imposing spending limits, which would indirectly more or less have the same effect.
Well, tell me something. I've never been that enthusiastic about term limitation. My argument has always been, well, if you have term limitation, the rascals are going to do what they're going to do anyway, but just much faster with term limitations. But however, I do see some, I can be convinced of some benefits in the form of reducing the power of some of the committees, and that might be a very, very important aspect. But I don't quite, I don't fully see the benefit of term limitation, and I'd be willing to.
Well, considered in isolation, I agree with you. I don't see term limitation as the be-all, end-all to solve these problems. Again, it does seem to me that term limitation, for some reason, and again, this is mysterious, it does seem to me that it has the potentiality of capturing the imagination of the people behind it. Whereas some of these other things, even though they are maybe simple to you and I, They're complicated to people out there. But term limitations, you throw the rascals out or you only allow them so long in. Now, the direct impact of term limitations, as you suggest, might not be nearly as much as we would hope they might be. But on the other hand, I think to remove or reduce the power of these incumbent barons in the Congress is very important. I think to get Tom Foley and Rostenkowski and others like that out is a very important aspect of the whole thing. And just the sort of threat of that coming has already had some impact, I think.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the, for me, term limitation, or focus on term limitation, yes, you're right that it kind of focuses the public mind and is very simple and something to understand. It might have some additional benefits, but term limitation in and of itself, it seems to ignore the basic problem. And the basic problem I see is, or at least one of the basic problems, is that congressmen and senators, for the most part, are doing precisely what their constituents elect them to do.
Yeah.
And but it just turns out when you have 535 congressmen all doing what their constituents want, it produces something that none of us likes, such as high deficits and growing debt and increasing government. And so it seems to me, and at least this is what I try to do, that's why I call myself kind of a pamphleteer like Tom Paine, is that you have to convince the American people at the grassroots level about the problems of a
I fully share that. And in that sense, the term limitation excitement about term limitation is misconceived. It sort of diverts attention away from the central problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the central problem is quite properly, as you suggest, that we don't have any way that a political leadership can survive unless it does this constituency interest. Mm-hmm. That is, we're all screwing each other.
That's right.
Separate groups, or as Digisay says, the churning state. We're just churning back and forth, back and forth, and end up everybody worse off.
Or we become a nation of thieves.
Exactly.
And we've lost the morality, the moral force of the Constitution that has enabled us to become this nation of thieves. And I know I used to call it a zero-sum game, but some of my colleagues have told me that I've been overly optimistic. It's a negative-sum game.
And I think it's a particular tragedy that we in America have gone this way. As you and I know, we have a colleague here in philosophy, Thelma Levine, who's done a lot of television in philosophy courses and so forth. And Thelma makes the point that among all the, among all the countries, the nations, we have a set of documents. We have a set of documents that can provide the moral foundations, as you say, and instead we ignore those documents. I mean, Britain, for example, doesn't have such a thing, but we have the Declaration, we have the Constitution. So in a sense, we're not using the capital value that those documents could provide in accomplishing what you and I are talking about. That is, this sort of philosophical understanding of what we're about as a people. And to see that having eroded and see it still eroding and see absolutely no understanding or no sensibility toward that, it's a tragedy of major proportion.
And you say but we're not even teaching our children these principles in the school, in a high school or junior high school civics class, what the Constitution means. Matter of fact, I was listening to a report on a survey. It could have been done by a Gallup poll, and they were asking people, from where, whence comes the statement, from each according to their ability and to each according to their needs.
Yeah.
And a large percentage said it's in the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And then when you hear Americans say, in terms of the ignorance of our Constitution, when you hear Americans say, well, Reagan cut taxes or President Clinton's going to increase taxes, it shows that they have little knowledge of Article 1, Section 7 and 8 of the Constitution, whereby only Congress has that authority. And it's very, very tragic, and I think a lot of it has to do with our education system. Not even at colleges do we focus on constitutional principles in a government class. We're talking about issues having to do with redistribution as opposed to getting down to whether we are engaged.
And even in our law schools, I've often made the comment that the most subversive institutions in the country are the law schools. even our law school, with very, very few exceptions, as you know, the law students who will become our judges ultimately are taught that the Constitution is what the judges say it is. I mean, it's just this, you know, they just write their own values into the Constitution. Now, to some extent, that attitude, which was reflective of the Earl Warren Court, dramatically so, to some extent, the courts more recently have tried to go back a little bit from that sort of judicial legislation position, but that's still very, very much a part of the training in our law schools.
So, matter of fact, I've given lectures at two of the nation's most prestigious law schools. And in one case, the professor who got up to comment on my statements at one school, he said, told the students that you've just listened to the bankrupt notions of the Lochner era.
Exactly.
And then another professor at this other law school, he says that he told the students that you've heard of those discredited, you just heard the discredited notions of freedom of contract and rule of law.
Right.
And this is at a law school where there's such contempt for the rule of law.
No, and I don't know how we turn that around, because the role of lawyers are getting more and more important. There's getting to be, of course, as you know, a public attitude that's negative toward lawyers, and that's all to the good, where we have, you know, we have so many lawyers, so much litigation, that the lawyers, their relative esteem in the rankings is now pretty low compared to what it was 30, 40 years ago. But how we're going to get our politics out of the hands of the lawyers is another question. We got far too many lawyers in positions of executive power, positions of legislative power. State legislatures, Congress is dominated by lawyers who are trained by the law schools of precisely the sort that you're talking about, and so it's a major problem that we face.
And then you, aside from just the issues of the fact that we've escaped the constitutional restraints on government, is that I don't see the stability conditions for a tranquil society. That is, as government gets larger and larger and plays a greater role in the allocation of resources, then people tend to form coalitions to get their share of the of that allocation on some of the most destabilizing characteristics, such as regional characteristics, religious characteristics, racial characteristics. And we're in the process of creating instability in our society. And you know, one of the rather remarkable things that a lot of people don't think of is that if you ask the question, for most of our history, people have been able to live in relative harmony in the United States. People from very, very diverse backgrounds and religions. And one of the reasons, I suspect, is that in the United States, for most of our history, it did not pay to be an Irishman. It did not pay to be an Italian. Okay, now as government gets larger and larger, well, then it begins to pay to be members of various groups, just in terms of allocation of resource, and this contributes to instability in our society.
Well, I think that's a very, very important, and I think it is happening. And our politics is increasingly becoming what I call just simply distributional politics. That's all. I'm fighting to get my share, and obviously I do better if I join a coalition, if I'm in a group that's identifiable in some other, in one or another of these ways. And not only do we place demands on government, but we force our elected politicians to represent different groups. So you exacerbate that by then deliberately fixing up your legislative process such that you have a representation of separate interests rather than a sort of a generalized representation of people who might reflect a little bit the encompassing interest.
Yeah.
So I think that's a very, very serious aspect of our modern politics, and this this emphasis on diversity in the universities is sort of providing a kind of an intellectual backdrop to a lot of that.
Which is very interesting. You point out the universities. The intellectual elite have been supporters of some of the most horrendous phases of events in human history.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm very sure everybody knows that that Adolf Hitler got a lot of his original support from the intellectual elite and college students as well. And I think it's a tragedy unfolding, particularly at our universities.
Yeah, but I think in a sense it is a tragedy, and it's dramatic changes in our structure. But some of these things, sometime, and maybe we should put a little bit of hope in this picture, some of these things sometimes overreach themselves. Mm-hmm. And there has been an overreaching by some of those groups that are pushing a lot of that repression. Mm-hmm. That I was just reading last week, where some of the leaders of that movement, like Richard Rorty and Stanley Fish and mm-hmm. Derrida, who have been used as the sort of the intellectual gurus of a lot of that, have now issued statements trying to draw it back. Uh-huh. They realize it's gone too far. And so maybe there are signs that the partial derivatives at least have changed. So,
and then there's another optimistic note on it, is that the universities can be a laboratory for the rest of society. That is, we can try things and they'll turn out to be utter failures at the universities, and we might realize this. You know, there's another part of the problem of the growth of government, and that has to do with a lot of demagoguery about the sources of income, mm-hmm. and which gives rise to the political incentives for redistribution of income.
Yeah.
And the demagoguery that I see is that nobody actually says it, but they almost say that there's a pile of money somewhere in the mm-hmm. United States, mm-hmm. and the rich or the well-off, they're rich because they got to that pile first and they took somebody else's fair share. And so justice requires redistributing the income. Yeah. And I think that's a major problem in our, just in terms of thinking about these problems. And as I frequently tell people, that for the most part, there's some exceptions. Those who have money, those who are wealthy, they became so, at least in a free society, by pleasing their fellow man, by serving their fellow man. And you hear the statement that, well, those who are wealthy, they should give something back to society. Yeah. I think that is nonsense. Yeah. They've already given something.
Right, exactly.
Now, it's the social parasites or the thieves that should give something back because they've taken and they haven't given anything. And so I spend, at least on when I go around the country lecturing, I spend a lot of time talking about the demagoguery about the sources of income. That's a very, very important.
Oh, I do. I think that's very important, and it's very difficult. And I think a lot of us don't understand how difficult it is for the ordinary person to keep from being attracted by that kind of a view. Because I can appreciate that view because I came out of that view. I started out from a very strong populist family, populist background, in which the Wall Street barons were, in fact, stealing from all the rest mm-hmm. of us, and so we wanted to get the money away from those bastards. That was our sort of attitude came up with. And you sort of naturally come into the view, and this is where I think those of us who teach economics, and a lot of economists anyway, get far too, we get attracted by the complexities of economic ideas mm-hmm. and fool around and on the blackboard and computers and so forth. We don't sort of spend enough time teaching the public or the students we get this very, very elementary point mm-hmm. that you're making here, the very, very elementary point that in order to have income, somebody's got to produce the income. It's as if it's out there, as you say. It's out there somehow to be picked up, and the people happen to find it, they get it, and you know, therefore we should share it.
Yes.
If we could get that very simple point across, we would have long since made more than our contribution. But it's very difficult to do. It's very difficult for the ordinary person to somehow accept the sort of fact that in order to generate product or value, it has to be done by somebody. And in order to do that, in order to get rich, you have to provide something that somebody will buy.
Mm-hmm.
And we just, in a way, economics, as someone said, as my old professor said, Frank Knight once said, economics is so easy you can learn it in half an hour, but it takes you a long time to get to the point where you can learn it, you know? Yeah, so.
Yes, and you know, I even go as far in terms of simplicity. a lot of times I don't call, when I'm out on a lecture tour, I don't call dollars dollars. I call them certificates of performance.
Oh, and, that's very good. I like that. That's
and that, and when I, you know, I can, I mow your lawn, and you give me 10 certificates of performance, and this stands as as evidence that I've served my fellow man.
Yeah,
and so then I can go into a store, and say, look, I demand what my fellow man produces, and see, here's the certificates of performance.
Yeah. Oh, that's very good. I like that.
And contrast that morality, the morality of that, where the only way you can have a claim on what your fellow man produces is by serving him. If you contrast that to government allocation of resources, the government says, look, you can sit on your butt. You can watch TV all day. Yeah. You don't have to serve your fellow man, and we will take what he produces.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's some, even my colleague Karen Vaughn, our colleague Karen Vaughn, and some others, who are spending some time talking about the connection between Christianity and free markets, and that there's some kind of morality in the free market. And if you're if you happen to be a Christian, you can accept the free market. The it's far more consistent with free market principles than socialism is consistent with Christianity.
Well, there is getting to be, as you suggest, not only amongst our colleagues, but throughout our profession and others, much more interest in sort of the connection between economics and ethics and this sort of thing. Not so necessarily a religious base, but generally, ethics generally. In my own, I've been working for the last almost a decade now, very much trying to look at the sort of economic content of the set of Puritan virtues, the Puritan ethic. And in particular, I've been working on the work ethic, the attitude that people work, attitude that people should save, attitude that they should respect others' property, this sort of thing, the kind of general Puritan virtues, which may or may not have a religious or Christian base, may have a Judeo-Christian base, may have other in other religions. But the point is, those the presence of that ethic among members of the public has a very, very strong economic content. And it that's what gives people the notion to go out and generate these badges and get these certificates of performance. Because if you sort of think that, well, the government owes you a living, then you're never going to get that. Mm-hmm. And we've been destroying those virtues. I mean, we've been deriding those virtues, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things as we attack and deride these virtues, we tend to think that codified law can be a substitute for these institutions that tend to control and moderate the unpleasant aspects of human behavior. And we're finding out that it's a very, very poor substitute.
That's right.
I think that if you look at, again, one does not have to necessarily be a Christian, but you see in almost every philosophy, or at least many philosophies, there's a phrase that's expressed in Christianity, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a very profound statement if you look at it from an economic standpoint of view. It's a way to, as we economists say, internalize externalities without the law. That if you really believe that, I shouldn't walk across your lawn.
Right.
Because I don't want you to walk across my lawn.
Right.
Well, that's a very, very effective way of internalizing externalities, and we're losing, we've lost contact with the, or we've lost many of these institutions that moderated human behavior as a result of, and much of it as a result of government activity.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. People can live together much better if they have a kind of an ethical bond in which they kind of have mutual respect for each other and respect the other's boundaries, personal boundaries, property boundaries, contractual obligations, and so forth. The people in Yugoslavia, for example, live together, the Croats and the Serbs and the Muslims lived together fine under schemes in which they knew that they were going to respect each other's each other's rights, and you only get that terrible, terrible conflict because they realize if they become a minority under a government-dominated group of the other side, then they're going to have nothing left. And so it's once you get politics in it, you're going to, as you already said, you're going to establish these coalitions which are simply going to use politics as getting back into a war of each against all. That is the mm-hmm. kind of zero or negative sum game that that modern politics represents. Mm-hmm. Again, we must get back somehow to a constitutional understanding about this. One thing that has concerned me a lot, coming at it with a bit of a specialty in the fiscal side of things, is how we did make some progress, it seemed to me, and or we reversed the general trend of events in 1986 in terms of our tax code. 86 Act legislation was rather strange in the sense we went away from trying to satisfy particular groups as distributional politics. We lowered the rates in exchange for getting the base broadened and closed up a lot of particularized shelters, particularized loopholes. We got a simplified structure. And that was kind of a miracle, political miracle, so to speak, yes. in the modern age. I made a prediction. I wrote a piece about it, saying it won't hold from public choice perspectives. Immediately, the Congress wants to get the rate lowered and the base widened, will start raising the rates. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they'll start selling off these loopholes again, which is precisely what has happened. It didn't last. They started raising rates again. And, of course, they're going back selling rents. If you satisfy me, I'll give you a particular tax break. If you satisfy me, I'll give you another one break. And so now the thing is, it's been broken apart. But so even when we have some temporary steps that seem to go back toward a generalized understanding of these principles of sort of limitation or generality, rule of law in our fiscal structure in particular and elsewhere, even when we get that, we don't allow it to last.
It's eroded.
It's eroded.
Well, I'm a little more cynical than you on that. I said during a time that the reason why Congress was broadening the base and getting rid of loopholes is because it didn't have anything to sell.
Yeah.
There are too many loopholes in there.
So close them and then they sell them again.
That's right. That's right. So if you were a man from Mars, you might say, well, gee, this is a deliberate act.
Yeah.
It doesn't represent a kind of understanding as you're suggesting. Yeah. But that's just my particular cynicism about politicians.
No, I don't think we necessarily disagree very much on that. I think that they're always going to be there. But why? And in one sense, you're right. That may have been the reason that we got that change, is because they had exhausted their possibilities.
Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the big problems that Americans don't understand is just I don't know whether we fully understand the impact of government on the rest of society, the impact of regulations, people can engage, or let's say special interest groups can engage in strategic behavior through regulations. That is, we look at the government, the federal government, consuming roughly 25% of the GNP. Well, that's if we stick with just cash.
Yeah.
But if you look at regulations, where government makes mandates instead of saying, "Well, look, we're going to take $20 out of your pocket, Jim. Yeah. We're going to make a law that you have to give Williams $20," or that, or let's say tariffs is a form of redistribution of income, and I don't know whether Americans fully appreciate just the increase in role of government and the effect that it has on their standard of living. Mm-hmm.
No, I'm sure they don't. I'm sure they don't. I mean, these are indirect, and that's, of course, the reason why you have regulations, mandates, and particularized interferences that have their impact indirectly. Take tariffs as an example. You could probably never get, even in the modern era, you probably couldn't get a particular subsidy to a particular industry. Domestic industry that would be overtly financed by tax dollars, it would be equivalent to the tariff.
Yes.
Because the argument, people don't understand the simple economics of free trade.
Mm-hmm.
Again, go back to what I said earlier, and I think this is something to keep stressing, that those of us who are in economics, and we ought to spend a lot more time teaching the simple verities, and not so much in this esoteric stuff.
That's right. And I'm going to continue to do my share of these, and I'm quite sure you're going to continue to do your share. And we've raised a lot of questions, and we don't have all the answers, but perhaps, as you suggest, we can get.
Yeah, I would just say more power to you. I think that you're doing a really wonderful job in this, you know, in getting some of this message across to the public. I've never not been very good at that, but I certainly admire your persuasiveness.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah.